Eoch tanuyap, kuige iwans kuyens na. Hi everybody, my name is kuige iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yagalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
It's 8 p.m. and you're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. I'm Sandy Goldman, and tonight we return to Ontario's Muskoka region to check in with the Ryde Community Co-op. Over the past 20 years, this rural co-op has grown to over 250 members. They rallied to buy the former two-room school, which houses programming across generations. But since the COVID-19 pandemic began, the school, or community center, has been closed. How has Ryde Co-op adapted and continued to serve its members and neighbors? I asked Board President Nancy Cronin. Here's our discussion. Welcome, Nancy. Thanks for joining us on Each for All.
Thank you very much, Sandy, for inviting me. I appreciate the reach out to the Ryde Community Co-op and our community.
Nancy, how has the Ryde Co-op been adapting to the COVID-19 pandemic? Because so much of your programming and everything gears around the building, which was the former two-room schoolhouse that Ryde bought a number of years ago and actually owns. So I imagine the building shut down. What have you been doing to continue to reach out to members in light of the pandemic? Let's start there.
Well, we closed our doors on March the 14th, and we opened our hearts, and that's sort of been a good line for us to use because we're very social, and I think that's something about the community co-op. The Ryde Community Co-op, because we're such a rural area that we as individuals and as community members rely on is being able to see each other and support each other in that manner of going to the co-op and such a small little building. It's a big wide community. So that was a bit of a shock for us, certainly as board members. You plan for your community, you plan programming, and now what? So we reached out to our community with Facebook, with our webpage, but then there's also people that are not connected in that way. So we were able to, as a board as well, and we are 100%, as you know, Sandy, 100% volunteer driven and volunteer board at the Ryde Community Co-op. So we would call certain individuals, see what their needs are. Going forward, we were very fortunate within the first month to start receiving some reach out from the District of Muskoka, realizing our community center, they were given a social service relief fund set up through the Ontario government for what they called the COVID-19 Relief Fund. We received some funding for that, and appropriately we distributed that into our community through our initial reach out was, if you need groceries, if you need running, if you need anything, please reach out to us. Which I have to admit, Sandy, and I think I mentioned this before, it was a difficult thing to do because people would not, really self-identify as having any needs. I think being in a rural community, so many individuals and families, are self-supporting within their own support infrastructure, meaning friends, family, neighbors. So, you know, in when the storm hits, so to speak, no pun intended, they're there to help. But this has been going on for some time. So what we did in the interim is we started buying grocery cards. We decided that, you know what, if you won't come to us, maybe we can come to you. And again, what we would do is we would sort of identify without, you know, saying too much, because confidentiality, of course, is priority. And we were starting to put grocery cards that they could use at one of the grocery stores in one of our towns here in Gravenhurst. And that seemed to be a quiet success. We were getting feedback on that, and we'd get the odd little thank you card in our mailbox. So we knew we had done the right thing. And then we thought, well, we had this little lending library, and we were just before the COVID-19 closure, we were going to set it up. And instead, we installed it at the building outside, and it is our pantry. So we are keeping that. And again, quietly, people are finally coming to use it. And again, I think nobody wanted to use it. They just didn't feel like maybe they didn't qualify. I'm not sure. So the last post I did was I said, hey, save that trip to town. Hey, save that risk. You know, did you forget this? Did you forget that? And all very slowly but surely, and we've been stocking it as well with personal protective equipment, meaning hand sanitizer. We also have a family so kindly, and we are supporting that family by buying them material, and they are in turn keeping busy, wanting to stay busy because they're not working, and making masks for us. And so we're putting those out to the community as well.
So those are really terrific initiatives. When I was there and did a feature, I guess 3 years ago, I know that we talked a lot about the rural lifestyle, and there was a lot of pride, a great deal of resilience, and fiercely independent. I remember one person that I met with, she was 90-something at that point, and strong as an ox. I shovel my own driveway. I chop my own wood, and she was doing great. So maybe there is that on the one hand, wanting to connect with people, missing the social aspect, but asking for help in terms of the basics. Maybe there's a lot of pride. So it sounds like the way you're doing it discreetly through the pantry box. And leaving gift cards for members at the grocery store, and that might be the way to go. I guess it's trial and error for the board, right?
It is.
See what works.
We're reinventing the wheel, but the wheel's actually just it's turning a little slower, but we're just putting some more wheels back on the wagon, so to speak. Because, you know, again, it was all about programming and bringing people into the building and that social aspect of it. So, I mean, it's still that community continues to thrive, continues to, you know, they're just, you know, what go, you know, it's behind the closed door. And we continue to always say, and this has been our line, that, you know, we're more than bricks and mortar, you know, we're more than just walls. And again, there are young families we need to support as well. It isn't just seniors in our community. And that was just before the pandemic. That was in the last few months prior to that. This is something that we were trying to, another aspect of the community center we were trying to tackle, because there was sort of this misnomer, I believe, because seniors did start it. Seniors did start the community center. And we are associates of the Ontario Association of Senior Centers, which is a wonderful thing to have. So a lot of young families were like, well, this is not a senior center. So we were trying to sort of tackle that. And by doing that, we also had the early on years. We were, the District of Muskoka started the early on years. So from, you know, plus 1 month to 5 years of age, bring your children for free for 2 hours every Friday for a supportive environment with, you know, a District of Muskoka employee who is well educated in early childhood education. So that was getting people together and starting that change ever so slightly to say, hey, maybe, you know, this is a something we can do, and starting more family programming, starting monthly having craft nights or family night, or one night, you know, they had the Polar Bear Express where they had everybody came in their pajamas and they had pizza and popcorn and watched a movie, and then they were sent home with one of these dollar store lights that they could put on in their vehicle as they left the co-op in the dark, you know. So that's been difficult too, but again, we have funding specifically for now for young families and for families. So again, we are doing just that because sometimes both are not working and sometimes one may be going back to work.
Nancy, so, sorry, you told me that you have 250 members of the Rye Community Co-op. So that's quite substantial from a few years ago when I was there. Yes. And mm-hmm. and also, I think you've really grown to incorporate intergenerational programming and having the younger folks and families and little ones. I did see a recent promotional video on your website, and it's mm-hmm. really glorious to see that. I know there was a youth camp or something like that right nearby mm-hmm. as a neighbor. So that's really great. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, you received some money to build an outdoor accessible pavilion. That was quite a sizable grant from the Trillium Foundation, about $92,000. Sure. So will that project be going forward?
Yes. Yes, it is. We just got our building permit, so we're thrilled. Absolutely thrilled with that. So in fact, the actual building itself, the actual pavilion, was being pre-assembled and pre-built off-site, so we were just waiting for our permits to go ahead with that. So going forward with the opening, we're now in stage two with the Ontario Premier and introducing that on Monday. So by this Monday, on the 15th of June, again, stage two also incorporates now community centers, but there are there's certain things we have to abide by, and one being, you know, no gatherings. They've actually increased the numbers to 10, but again, with our small space, we just can't do that. And having this pavilion, it couldn't have come at a better time, in all honesty, with, you know, this, you know, the COVID, relief funds that we have been getting, because we can also put that out there. People are now sort of turning their heads and now looking and saying, hey, you know, the Rye Community Co-op is helping us now. Because, right. You know, we really always did, but now it's more physical. So I think that now we can do this. There's going to be outside. We have 5 acres. With the building. Yeah. So this, people can now, so this is what we're looking forward to is now, okay, if we're going to start planning going forward, people are not going to be comfortable. I know that, you know, we know that. They're not going to be comfortable in close confined spaces. So let's do these programs. What programs can we move outside? What can we do outside? How can we encourage people to get back together again and be outside? And this pavilion going up, I think, will be just one of the best things for this community.
Right. As people are starting to poke their heads out and kind of check if the coast is clear and can I go outside? And we know in British Columbia, our provincial officer of health, Dr. Bonnie mm-hmm. Henry, has said outside is good. So still those distances, but outside is good. And so with summer coming there and it could be very fortuitous. And like you say, you've got that acreage and people can maybe start to gather at a distance and start to see each other, which is really great. You have a quite a a diverse group of people working both as volunteers and in your membership. How are the people kind of keeping connected? Are you doing any online programming? I know you offer Tai Chi and yoga and the VON exercises. Have you been able to do anything remotely just to keep people connected?
Well, we have been doing, the VON itself has been doing that for our membership and those individuals that had signed with them or were participating before this, before the COVID pandemic. So they've reached out because of that organization itself has reached out. We follow up on that. Our Tai Chi instructor is a community member. I myself, I have been doing a cardio sort of 20-minute little workout. That goes back a few years. But anyway, you know, because we're really, this community is pretty fit, actually, you know, when you put, when
well,
you
you've helped to keep them that way, yeah, you know, through the programming.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. I know when I first started at the VON and I said, if these women in their 80s can get to that co-op and get in and out of their car,
exactly,
you know, 12 months out of the year, you know, I can do it. So, the other thing is we've also been fortunate to partner with the YWCA, and we are partnering with them for a grant for tablets for seniors.
So terrific.
We also have a summer student that we're looking to hire, and I think we're going to hopefully, part of that hiring of that student will help, we'll get these seniors adapted to these tablets, you know, get them to learn how to do Facebook, get them to learn how to do FaceTime. And I think we've got Wi-Fi now hooked up at the co-op that actually is, you can use it outside. And so we're encouraging people to use that Wi-Fi outside as well. But now that we can open and with those two rooms, we can, hopefully people will feel comfortable within that six foot division between each other and get them with these tablets. And then they can have these tablets to take home as well. So they can utilize this and they can get in touch with their families. They can see each other. And it's going to be a learning curve, but I think most of them are pretty well up for it. And those that, there's a lot of seniors in our community as well that do have tablets, but it's not just the seniors. This is an issue within any rural community, certainly is having access to or good Wi-Fi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those are all great initiatives. I can just imagine in my mind's eye, a group of people in a large circle outside on your acreage on a nice day, tablet in hand, and learning, you know, various programs and ways to communicate and social media and this and that. And then, you know, gathering for some lemonade and snacks after.
Isn't that wonderful thought?
It could be wonderful because, as you say, you do have that acreage and the time is right. If you were going to sum up the heart of the RIDE co-op, how would you put it together in a way that people can understand, because it is such a special community, a resilient group of people, a caring community. What would you say about it?
Strength, first and foremost, resilience. I think you use that word as an excellent word to describe them, but caring and quietly caring and quietly supportive, because they're not out there to, you know, blow their own trumpet and they just know what needs to be done and you do it and you go home, right? It's always been like that. And it's just a wonderful environment. And we're just so appreciative. And I know that myself, as a fairly new board member, as the president now in the last only 4 or 5 months, but I was on the board previous to that. I just stepped back and watched really in awe. And as I said, it's more than bricks and mortar. And when I say that our doors are closed, but our hearts are open, and that certainly speaks for the community and the community center itself.
Well, you're really together, trying to stay together, even though you're apart physically. Right. And it sounds as you're entering stage two that you'll have more opportunities to do that. So we wish you all the best. We're happy for the funding that you've received, especially not only the funds to get you through the pandemic, and help members that way, but for the outdoor pavilion, because that's going to be really tremendous. And so we're very thankful. The Ride Co-op has a special place in my heart. Mm-hmm. When I met folks there 3 years ago, it was really a wonderful experience, and we've kept tabs on how you're doing, and we're so happy that you're able to move forward. So we wish you all the best from Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Take care.
And, thank you.
And all the best. And just a shout out to everyone there from me. And thank you so much for your time. We wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Sandy. And thank you very much for reaching out.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
Bye now.
That was Nancy Cronin, president of the Ride Community Co-op in rural Ride, Ontario. Thanks, Nancy, for sharing how the co-op continues to connect with members and neighbors during the COVID-19 pandemic. A reminder, you're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. Let's take a break, then come back with more of tonight's show.
Give me that!
It's mine!
I want it!
No, it's mine!
No, give it to me!
You have to give it back!
Stop! Instead of fighting, try working together. Honestly, openly, in a spirit of caring for others. And tune in to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. on CFRO 100.5 FM, on your dial and online at cooperadio.org. Try cooperating. You'll feel better for it.
And we're back. I'm Sandy Goldman, and this is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. Marc-André Pigeon is the director of the Canadian Centre for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. Research there shows that over the past many years, institutional support for cooperatives in Canada has fallen off. At the same time, we see concern for community growing, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. How can we raise public awareness of the cooperative model, especially with governments and other organizations? Our discussion ponders that perennial question and much more. I'm speaking with Marc-André Pigeon. He is the director of the Canadian Centre for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. Marc-André, welcome to Each for All. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a really real pleasure. Thank you.
We've talked to the center the last 3 years about the survey, the annual survey about the top 10 issues for co-ops. And each of the last 3 years, the top issue was public awareness of the cooperative model. Now, I'm wondering, first and foremost, is that survey going ahead this year, given that the top issue might be how to cope with the pandemic or help create the new normal post-pandemic?
Yeah, so we were planning on rolling out that survey this winter, but of course, COVID-19 landed, and we were a little concerned about both take-up in the midst of this crisis. Everyone was scrambling to just kind of figure out how to adjust to this new normal, and then also just the response. What would people would probably just tell us that COVID-19 is the issue du jour, and so we've decided to kind of put this on hold and revisit the question in the fall. And frankly, I mean, it would be good to pick up on some of that COVID-19 piece, but we don't want to be overwhelmed by it either. We want people to think beyond it, like you were suggesting. What does this mean for cooperatives going forward? So we're actively considering how we're going to kind of adapt and adjust that survey for given the new context.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that when you do get some results, when you proceed with that, because it's always interesting to know what cooperators are thinking across Canada and what's coming along. And it may be a very different take next time due to the pandemic. You know, when I was doing some research about the center, I came across this quote, front and center on your current homepage. And I'd like to read that because it's very apt and relates to so many issues that we're dealing with as a society. Many of the issues relate right to this, and I'm going to read it now. It says, the most pressing problems facing society are not moral, but institutional. When people are enabled to work together toward a common goal, they can change the world. Our research supports the building of policies, practices, and organizations that enable communities to create their own rules and meet their own needs. You know, I read that this morning and I was thinking about the debate right now about defunding police in light of the unfortunate and horrible murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the protests thereafter, and thinking about, well, you know, maybe there's other agencies, social service agencies, that should receive the funds to help people in need, not the police. And in that quote, which sounds like part of the mission of the center, we find that applying to concern for community and the cooperative model. How do you take that idea, those ideals, and move them forward at the center?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, part of what we're hoping to do with the center, and we've just celebrated our 35th anniversary last year. And so there was an opportunity to kind of rethink and repurpose the center a little bit. And one of the ideas that has come to the fore and that I'm particularly interested in is this idea of focusing on that institutional environment and how it enables or discourages the formation of self-organization of cooperatives at the local level. And I think what's happened over the last 30, 40 years is an evolving institutional environment that's becoming less hospitable to cooperatives. You know, and there's a lot of, there's ecologists who've developed an interest in cooperatives. In fact, we had one of them speak to us. His name is Tim Waring, and he's used biological principles or ideas to think about cooperatives. And if you don't have an environment that's favorable to the creation of cooperatives, a policy environment, an institutional environment, it's going to be hard for those plans to take hold, you know. And the classic example of just how much an institutional environment can shape behavior and outcomes is, you know, the literature points often to the contrast between, say, the United States, which is kind of a freewheeling capitalism, and then Germany, which is kind of a managed capitalism. And you see very different behavior in those two societies. One society tends to invest in long-term, productive, involves a lot more of a kind of relationships with labor organizations. The other one is the exact opposite, very innovative, but also, you know, dog eat dog. And so one supports people, one lets them fall off. One's innovative, one's less innovative. And so it's largely, the research is showing, I think increasingly, it's largely an institutional environment that determines which of those worlds you get. And so I think in the last 30 or 40 years, unfortunately, our policymakers have lost any kind of conception that there's this other option out there, this cooperative option. And they've let some of the structures that were previously supportive of the cooperative sector kind of fall off. And I think that's what we're trying to say. Let's pay attention to that and let's put some emphasis there so that then when the seeds get planted, they have a rich environment to grow in.
So Marc-André, what would be some of those institutions or the fertile ground that was there once for cooperatives, right, that is not there now? But I have a feeling we're seeing the seeds being replanted because of the pandemic. But give us a bit of the history, because that's something that you study. Where were we and what are you lamenting?
Yeah, it is a bit of a lament. I mean, so there used to be, you know, take Saskatchewan, there used to be a Department of Cooperatives. That doesn't exist anymore. There were people who were, there was a unit within government that was devoted to the cooperative sector. Now it's a few desks hidden away somewhere in another department. The federal government used to have a cooperative secretariat. There's maybe two people working on that in that area versus 100 or more 10, 15 years ago. Taxation policy. There used to be, cooperatives used to be tax exempt. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that's the way to go, but just to give you a sense of things, in other jurisdictions, like the United States, interestingly, cooperatives are tax exempt.
In places
like Italy or Spain, they pay much lower tax rates and are incentivized to build up capital so they can grow and be sustainable over time. So the tax system actively encourages cooperative development. The only place that has, I think, done a really good job in North America, or sorry, in Canada, to kind of institutionally support cooperatives in Quebec. And interestingly, that's the province where you see the most cooperative formation, the most kind of vigorous cooperative sector, where people take the idea and run with it in every direction, you know, whether it's a car share co-op or a food delivery co-op or a telecom co-op. You know, the idea is vibrant there, but it's vibrant because we've created a fertile garden to plant those seeds. Everywhere else in Canada, the idea is kind of pretty much fallen off the table, and policymakers have a huge role to play in putting it back into the mix of active solutions to our problems.
So is this some of the work that is going on at the center right now, exactly that question? How can you raise public awareness at the federal and provincial policymaker level of the co-op model? So what are you proposing, or what are the minds thinking around that, the people who are doing that research at the center, because we want practical solutions.
Right. So there's a lot of ways of approaching this. And, you know, we're a small team of basically three people, so we can only...
Oh, come on, you can do it.
But that's it. I mean, here's where we're putting our energies. Like one, you know, so for example, I'm doing research into taxation cooperatives. That area of research has been dormant for about 40 years. You know, the last thing that's been written in that area was probably 1984. So 36 years ago. And, you know, whereas if you go to the United States, there's a vigorous literature there. If you go to Europe, there's a vigorous literature there. It's disappeared from the Canadian landscape. And so when policymakers say, what is this patronage, you know, just to illustrate, God forbid they should remove this, but this is what happens in the policy mindset. Someday somebody opens a manual and they've got all these deductions and exemptions and tax credits, and they're seeing this one around patronage. What is this? What does this even mean? Why are we letting cooperatives deduct patronage from their income? And then they look around, they ask their colleagues, oh, hey, buddy, what's this about? I have no idea. You know, so the what happens is it becomes very easy to say, let's just get rid of it. And so you have no institutional knowledge, no literature to turn to. You go on Google, you go on Google Scholar, you go to your academic libraries, you find nothing. And so you're left to kind of say, well, the easiest thing to do is just get rid of it. So that's the kind of environment that we've created. And what we're doing is producing research that hopefully will help address that. But we also have through the policy school, a certificate in social economy and cooperatives that is aimed at policymakers, both in and outside of government, that would give them some of this grounding so that they wouldn't make these kinds of mistakes. And they have been making these kinds of mistakes repeatedly for the last 30 or 40 years. And so that's the kind of approach. And then there's just general education, like our Co-ops in a Time of Crisis series. One of the things we've been kind of emphasizing there is the policy dimension of this crisis and the way federal governments, mostly the federal government, rolling out policy interventions and not always putting cooperatives at the top of the heap in terms of their access to these programs. And so this is another classic example where policymakers, and it's not because they're bad people. I mean, I'm a former policymaker. There are a lot of good people. They have very good intentions. They believe strongly in the public good. But if you don't have the concepts and the research to kind of activate those ideas, then you will make bad decisions. And I think that's what's been happening.
You know, the last little while, we do a regular check-in monthly with John Kay, of the president of the board of Co-ops and Mutuals Canada, and also the BC vice president of the BC Co-op Association. And we're talking with him regularly about government relations and raising awareness. And there have been a few gains over the last year, pre-COVID, where the government has included cooperatives. I think there was a program out of small business called Futurepreneur that was also applied finally to co-ops and some other things along the way. So bit by bit, really that whole issue of public awareness continues to be at the forefront here. Your series Cooperatives in a Time of Crisis, of course, that's very timely. There are a series of interviews that that you and your staff have done, and you can a person can see them on YouTube, and it looks like you've talked to quite a few of your funders, actually, a number of credit unions also co-ops locally in Saskatchewan and Alberta to find out what their experience is and how they're coping. Who is your audience for that series? Because it's got a lot of breadth and depth.
Right. So, I mean, I think we have multiple audiences. I don't know if there's any one audience. I mean, I think I think you always have to allow room for kind of serendipity and people kind of just landing on something and figuring, you know, finding it interesting. But I'd say generally the thinking was that we had the sector itself. So to kind of increase awareness about how amongst the sector about what was going on and also policymakers, frankly, particularly in the conversations I've been having, I've been trying to emphasize this policymaking perspective. And I think the general population. I mean, so I think in that order, you know, so the cooperatives themselves, policymakers, and the general public. But the idea is, again, that we want to kind of seize the moment. I think people are looking now and kind of open to considering other ways of doing things. And so you want to have content that's out there that's going to answer that call. And so that was the big picture mission, in a sense, is to kind of speak to the moment and bring awareness to the model.
Because we know that at the very beginning of the pandemic, there were a lot of leadership from credit unions, for example, to help people to defer mortgage payments and to make loans available. We were hearing that from VanCity and other credit unions across Canada well before the banks were responding and to these very real and crisis needs of people as the economy was shutting down. You have a lot of support from credit unions for the center. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that's, you know, this is a sector, again, like the cooperative sector in general, but I'd say particularly the credit unions, they have this challenge in terms of getting their story out. And it's a function of the model. It's funny enough, right? So if you open the Globe and Mail or the Financial Post or almost any newspaper, there's a business section. And the business section is full of stories about publicly traded companies. You can watch the share price go up and down and sideways. And those share price movements invariably generate news coverage. And so you get coverage by virtue of being an investor-owned publicly traded company, whether you put any effort into it or not. Whereas the cooperatives and credit unions in particular, there's none of that going on. There's no place you can go and watch the ups and downs of a stock price because there is no trading of their shares. And so this kind of biases coverage against them. And yet, and that has consequences, policy consequences, right? So when policymakers rolled out the emergency program that would provide up to $40,000 of interest-free loans to small businesses, the credit unions were initially off the eligible institution list. And yet in places like Saskatchewan and Manitoba, big parts of BC, credit unions are the small business lenders. And so what policymakers were inadvertently doing was basically writing off a big part of the country because of their lack of awareness, the lack of top of mind presence of the credit unions in their thinking. And that's partly a function of media coverage, partly a function of jurisdictional issues, the eternal Canadian dilemma. But it's also a function of the sector getting its word out too. And so, you know, this series in part, like I said, had this kind of objective of meeting not just the community of cooperatives, but also the policymaking community and the larger community so that these issues elevate and become more front in mind. So one of my big kind of research interests is behavioral economics. And it's very clear that there's this concept of salience. If you're not hearing about, and if the ideas aren't bombing your head every day, they're just not going to be there. It's not because you're bad. It's not because you don't care. It's because this is how humans are built. And so you need to amplify. You need to get the voice out there. And so we can do a little bit in that, always with an objective of influencing the policy environment, but that's kind of where we're kind of pushing.
Now, to follow up on that financial loan through the federal government, were credit unions, and this is in response to the pandemic, are credit unions now eligible for that? For
yes,
their members?
Yes.
Okay, so and how did that happen that somebody sent a memo or something to the federal government? I'm just curious, behind the scenes, who got through to the government on that?
Well, I think collectively the credit unions did. And I mean, that's one of the good news stories out of this crisis is the credit unions, probably in a way that they haven't in recent memory, really worked collectively to kind of get this outcome, to make sure they got rolled into this program. They used their centrals, which are these second tier organizations that exist largely on a provincial basis, but also a regional basis. And they use them as tools to kind of focus their advocacy, but also as the conduit for the delivery of this program, right? Just there's a lot of procedure and templates and mechanisms that go into the delivery of these kinds of programs. And the credit unions found out again, like they've known for years that sometimes forget that these second tier institutions can be very powerful efficiency devices and communications tools and learning tools. And so you've heard, if you listen to some of the credit union discussions, you'll hear this theme kind of come up over and over again. The credit union leaders will say, well, for the first time in a while, we've really seen how we were able to work effectively together. And because coming into this crisis, the sector was not happening so much. There've been some kind of failures of the sector to work together. There've been a few successes, but overwhelmingly more failures of the sector to work collectively. And this crisis has kind of given them a renewed energy to that kind of collective action.
Well, that's terrific. So pulling together there for the sake of the sector and making some changes with the federal government. Now, Marc-André, you have a background in communications and journalism. I'm sensing that coming through with these kind of efforts to raise public awareness, to get things on the business page, perhaps, or through the cooperatives in a time of crisis. Because again, that fundamental call that we were hearing from co-ops through the survey of the last 3 years is people don't know what a co-op is. So many don't. So I think that augurs well for the work that's being done at the center and to break it down and let people know how co-ops, what the cooperative difference is. Do you find you're applying those communication skills here?
Yeah, for sure. And I should say, I'm a bit of a student of the history of ideas as well. And it's always remarkable to me how new ideas kind of come in and take over or become kind of normed, become commonplace. And, I think of with social media in particular now, there are ways of kind of circumventing the traditional, what people call the mainstream media, right? In the past, if you wanted an idea to have a currency, you had to get into the mainstream papers. And that's still to some extent true, but there are these other channels now, Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram and so on, that really give power to these other ideas. And I think cooperatives are really starting to use them. We're starting to use them more conscientiously. But I'm also, so that's strategically, but I'm also mindful that policymakers, again, and this is a kind of my assumption of how human behavior works, is that we have perhaps less agency than we like to think we do. We are probably more subject to the whims of currents of thinking and ideas than we like to think. We like to think we make all our own decisions very rationally, but I think most of our decisions are informed by the broader cultural and media environment, frankly. So this is, I've seen this play out in my policymaking roles time and time again. People get captive to ideas. They're not always well-reasoned, but if they hear them repeated often enough, they believe them and they act on them. And so that's kind of one of my missions, but it's also one of my missions from a research perspective to kind of bring that to the fore and use that thinking to drive research as well.
Now, you worked in Ottawa for many years, and now you're in Western Canada. You're in Saskatoon, and I read a quote from you, I think, upon accepting your position as director at the center, something to the effect of a policy is made in Ottawa, but the best policy and practical solutions come from outside Ottawa, something to that effect.
Right.
And there you are in Saskatchewan. What's the cooperative feeling there? And what do you observe in terms of the cooperative sector in Western Canada? Because it has such a strong history. And as you say, we're lamenting the fact that the Saskatchewan Department of Cooperatives isn't around anymore, but there's such a proud history there. What's it like being part of the co-op sector, going from Ottawa to Saskatoon?
Well, it's exciting because while some of the institutional supports have kind of drifted away over the years, there's still a basic awareness more so than in Ottawa or Toronto or any of the kind of central Canadian kind of hubs. When I was in Ottawa, we used to have these parliamentary interns come and speak to us when I was at the in government, but also with the Trade Association for Credit Unions. And invariably, if the parliamentary interns were from Saskatchewan or Manitoba, we didn't have to explain what a cooperative was. Where anywhere else in the country, but particularly Toronto or Eastern Canada, a little more Halifax, those kind of bigger centers, it was blank stares. And so I find myself in a place where there's there's some basic understanding that you can leverage in a powerful way. And I'm reminded when I say that of some research done in the United States by a guy named Schneiberg. He's done some fantastic research that he documents how the institutional environment has changed in Midwestern United States, where the cooperative movement's always been the most powerful. So kind of analogous to Canada, frankly. And even today, states like Wisconsin and Minnesota. Have big, powerful cooperative sectors, but they have those sectors because there's institutional, he calls it flotsam and jetsam, these little pieces of legislation and structures and institutional supports that have lived on, that survived the big kind of neoliberal wave that started in the 1970s and 80s. And the modern day cooperatives have been able to leverage those institutional bits and pieces and rebuild a vigorous, a really powerful cooperative sector. And I think, I'm hopeful, I think, man, Western Canada has an opportunity to do something very similar. And the great thing about it is it's bipartisan in the United States, or it could be tripartisan in Canada. It's not Republican or Democrat. It wouldn't be NDP, Conservative, Liberal. It could be something that everyone can kind of hold hands and get behind. And so, in Wisconsin, the sector has, you go through school and teachers qualify as teachers have to know something about cooperatives. I mean, imagine that kind of institutional support in a Western province, right? Or the government thinks about crisis management and immediately assumes that we need to involve the cooperative sector. Again, these are policy interventions, or you have someone like Bill Omakin, who's been involved actively in that sector for a long time, who was running a consumer protection agency and market conduct agency and understands that you can treat the cooperative sector differently than an investor-owned firm because the owners are the clients, right? And so imagine we had that kind of leadership in our policymaking spaces who recognize those basic facts. Man, the world would be a very different place. And there's nowhere else in Canada outside of Quebec that has the kind of history, the culture, those flotsam and jetsam cultural features that make that likely, I think, right, in the short term. So it's exciting. It's really energizing. And I'm a little biased because I'm full on in the sector. So I see co-ops everywhere, but it does feel like they're more present, even though a lot of these institutional supports have frittered away over the years.
In covering the co-op sector the last 3 or 4 years, so many of the stories that I've done, a large number are based in Saskatchewan, many right there in Saskatoon. One story that comes to mind is Cooperatives First, which provides support to the co-op sector and specifically for rural and Indigenous co-ops in, mm-hmm. in Western Canada. And they grew out of a study that came from the center. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, a little bit. Now, that was before my time, but this was a major research undertaking funded by Federated Cooperatives and the cooperative retailing system, right? My understanding is there was a growing awareness that there was this kind of problem in rural Saskatchewan, rural Western Canada, where you had depopulation, but you also had real needs for services and goods, and businesses were kind of disappearing. And isn't this normally, you would expect this to be a kind of environment for cooperatives to prosper, where people would kind of naturally come together and self-provide, self-provision. But we weren't seeing that. And so they said, let's go and make sure that that's the case, that we're not misreading the evidence. And let's do some surveys. Let's talk to people out in rural Canada and amongst Indigenous communities, see what their level of awareness is, see what they, you know, how they think about the cooperative sector. And out of that came this recognition that we do have a problem here. We have an issue. Maybe there's some vigor in some of the bigger Sandy's centers like Saskatoon or Regina, but it seems the kind of the idea is not well anchored as a solution to problems in those rural and Indigenous communities. And so that's what led to this recommendation to create Cooperatives First, and Federated has funded them, and they're doing fantastic work to kind of try and turn that around. Again, this is in a sense, this is an institutional mechanism that the cooperative sector has itself created. And it is important for the cooperative sector to be engaged and not just look to government. As much as I put the emphasis on the policymaking environment, the cooperative sector can make a lot of that happen. Those tax benefits that the Italian co-ops enjoy, or that the Spanish co-ops enjoy, or that the US co-ops enjoy, they didn't just happen. They happened because the cooperative sector made it happen. And so this is an important step in, I think, rebuilding some of that institutional environment framework that will then hopefully generate more and more of sector.
Yes, Cooperatives First has a very large presence for anyone that's interested in co-ops. They have so many tools like the Co-op Creator. They have podcasts. They go out on the road and interview co-ops. They have a whole slate of advisors, and they really are putting out newsletters and information. They're a tremendous resource, and again, flowed out of a piece of research, yes, initiated by Federated Co-ops in the retail sector. But hey, you know, we've got something out of that that's benefiting. Right. All kinds of cooperatives. Last question before I let you go, and we've had a good discussion here, is how do you see co-ops being leaders, perhaps, and as we move into the new normal? There's already concern for community as a cooperative principle, and we see that concern across many communities. You don't have to be a cooperative. People are really pitching in. But since that's embedded in the cooperative values, how can we take that forward? Because I think there's a hunger to have a different kind of society, and co-ops could be real leaders. What's right. your sense of that, or what's the talk around that?
So it's I think the moment is ripe. Now, having said that, I mean, I think the moment was ripe after the financial crisis too, and not much changed. So, you know, I think that it's, while the moment is ripe, that doesn't mean it necessarily follows that you're going to see this kind of vigorous and blossoming cooperative sector that starts supplanting the way, you know, or taking up more space. I think the key is this kind of general mind shift towards recognizing the importance of resilience and sustainability. And if that anchors, if that really takes hold, then I think we are in a much better place for the cooperative sector. So there, you know, I think people will start hopefully increasingly thinking long-term and intergenerational, borrowing these ideas that are very ripe and pregnant in Indigenous communities, and that we've lost sight of because of largely the way we've structured our environment. Again, we create stock markets that reward short-term behavior and penalized long-term thinking. We have a whole sector out there that is built on and predicated on intergenerational thinking. So we are in the cooperative sector is in a sweet spot to leverage that shift in thinking, but it has to happen. The sector can be part of that conversation, but I think it needs to be broader based as well. I think people need to start moving beyond recognizing the need for more resilience, more not pursuing efficiency at all costs, but building in some slack. And I think as the mindset shifts in that direction, and if it shifts in that direction, then the cooperative sector will be really well placed to kind of take up more space in our lives.
As people have been taking a pause, a lot of people, not everybody, but it's a chance to reflect on not having to commute every day, the amount of hours that one might be spending doing that, as you say, chasing fast money. And as you say, the time is ripe for perhaps doing things differently going forward. Thank you so much, Marc-André, for spending this time with us, sharing the work of the Center for the Study of Cooperatives. We wish you all the best going forward. I encourage people to tune in to the Cooperatives in a Time of Crisis series, because it's tremendous, and it's a lot of great minds there, and just regular folk talking about how co-ops have been responding on behalf of their members during a very challenging time. We hope to hear from you again in the future as the Top Co-op Issues Survey goes forward. Please let us know when that's done, and we'll pick up the conversation then.
Great. Thank you so much, Sandy. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Bye now.
That was Marc-André Pigeon, Director of the Canadian Center for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. For further information on the center's research and links to the very timely Cooperatives in a Time of Crisis series, go to usaskstudies.coop. Thanks to my fellow cooperator Joshua Peterman for his help with tonight's show. Next week, we help celebrate the 75th anniversary of the People's Co-op Bookstore in Vancouver, and also learn about a new co-op that's bulk buying personal protective equipment for its community. I'm Sandy Goldman. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a cooperative week.
That you think is gonna last. Well, you wouldn't even know a diamond if you held it in your hand. The things you think are precious, I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years, stowing away?
Time I've known you, I still don't know what you mean. The weekend in the college didn't turn out like you planned. The things that pass for knowledge, I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the tears? Have you had enough of mine?